Fra Jed looked as if he hardly knew where to begin and couldn't be bothered, but Moira was game.
The signals are the interactions between cosmi that account for quantum effects. If you don't agree with the polycosmic interpretation, you must find some other explanation for those effects. But if you do agree with it, then to make it compatible with what we have long known about quantum mechanics, you must buy into the premise that cosmi interfere with each other when their world tracks are close together. If you restrict yourself to one particular cosmos, this crosstalk may be interpreted as a signal, a rather weak one, since it only concerns a few particles. If those particles are in an asteroid out in the middle of nowhere, it hardly matters. But when those particles happen to be at certain critical locations in the brain, why then, the signals can end up altering the behavior of the organism that is animated by that brain. That organism, all by itself, is vastly larger than anything that could normally be influenced by quantum interference. When one considers societies of such organisms that endure across long spans of time, and in some cases, develop world-altering technologies, one sees the meaning of Fra Jad's assertion that consciousness amplifies the weak signals that web cosmi together. Javarn had been nodding vigorously.
This tallies with some Atamant that I was reading yesterday evening. Consciousness, he wrote, is non-spatial temporal in nature. But it becomes involved with the spatial temporal world when conscious beings react to their own cognitions and make efforts to communicate with other conscious beings, something that they can only do by involving their spatial temporal bodies. This is how we get from a solipsistic world, one that is perceived by and real to only one subject, to the intersubjective world, the one where I can be certain that you see the copper bowl and that the thisness you attach to it harmonizes with mine.
Thank you, Sir Moira and Fra Javarn, said Ignatha Forel. Assuming that Fra Jad will maintain his gnomic ways, would you or anyone else care to take a crack at the second part of what he said?
I should be delighted to, said Fra Lodegear, since Fra Jad is sounding more and more Prokian every time he opens his mouth.
This earned Lodegear a lot of attention, which he reveled in for a few moments before going on.
By selective amplification, I believe Fra Jad is saying that not all intercosmic crosstalk gets amplified, only some of it. To cite Sir Moira's example, crosstalk affecting elementary particles in a rock in deep space has no effect.
No extraordinary effect,
Paphlagon corrected him.
No unpredictable effect. But mind you, it accounts for everything about that rock, how it absorbs and re-radiates light, how its nuclei decay, and so on.
But it all sort of averages out statistically, and you can't really tell one rock from another,
Lodegear said.
Yes.
Well, the point being that the only crosstalk capable of being amplified by consciousness is that affecting nerve tissue.
Or any other consciousness-bearing system,
Paphlagon said.
So there is a highly exclusive selection process at work to begin with, in that of all the crosstalk going on in a given instant between our cosmos and all the other cosmi that are sufficiently close to it to render such crosstalk possible, the stupefying enormous preponderance of it is only affecting rocks and other stuff that is not complex enough to respond to that crosstalk in a way we'd consider interesting.
Yes,
Paphlagon said. Let us then confine our discussion to the infinitesimally small fraction of the crosstalk that happens to impinge on nerve tissue. As I've just finished saying, this already gives us selectivity.
Lodegear nodded at the slate.
But whether or not Fra Jad intended to, he has opened the door to another kind of selection procedure that may be at work here. Our brains receive these signals, yes, but they are more than passive receivers. They are not merely crystal radios. They compute. They cogitate. The outcomes of those cogitations can by no means be easily predicted from their inputs. And those outcomes are the conscious thoughts that we have, the decisions we put into effect, our social interactions with other conscious beings, and the behavior of societies down through the ages.
Thank you, Fra Lodegear,
said Ignatha Forel, and turned to scan the slate again.
And would anyone care to tackle feedback loops?
We get those for free,
Paphlagon said.
What do you mean?
It's already there in the model we've been talking about, so we don't have to add anything more. We've already seen how small signals, amplified by the special structures of nerve tissue and societies of conscious beings, can lead to changes in a narrative, in the configuration of a cosmos, that are much larger than the original signals in question. The world tracks veer, change their courses in response to those faint signals, and you could distinguish a cosmos that was populated by conscious organisms from one that wasn't by observing the way their world tracks behaved. But recall that the signals in question only pass between cosmi whose world tracks are close together. There is your feedback. Crosstalk steers the world tracks of consciousness-bearing cosmi. World tracks that steer close together exchange more crosstalk.
So, the feedback pulls world tracks close to one another as time goes on? Ignatha Forel asked. Is this the explanation we've been looking for of why the geometers look like us?
Not only that, put in Sur Asquin, but of Kanoans and the HTW and all the rest, if I'm not mistaken.
I am going to be a typical Lorite, Moira said, and caution you that feedback is a layman's term that covers a wide range of phenomena. Entire branches of theorics have been and are still being developed to study the behavior of systems that exhibit what laymen know as feedback. The most common behaviors in feedback systems are degenerate, such as the howl from a public address system or total chaos. Very few such systems yield stable behavior, or any sort of behavior that you or I could look at and say, see, it is doing this now.
Thisness, Javarn exclaimed.
But conversely, Moira went on, systems that are stable in a tumultuous universe generally must have some kind of feedback in order to exist.
Ignatha Forel nodded.
So, if the feedback posited by Fra Jad really is steering our world track and those of the Pact races together, it's not just any feedback, but some very special, highly tuned species of it.
We call something an attractor, Paflagon said, when it persists or recurs in a complex system.
So, if it is true that the Pact share the Adrakonic theorem and other such theoretical concepts with us, said Fra Lodegear, those might be nothing more than attractors in the feedback system we have been describing.
Or nothing less, said Fra Jad.
We all let that one resonate for a minute. Lodegear and Jad were staring at each other across the table. We all thought something was about to happen. A Procyon and a Halicarnian were about to agree with each other. Then Javarn wrecked it. As if he didn't get what was going on at all. Or perhaps the HTW simply was not that interesting to him. He couldn't get off the topic of Adamant's bowl.
Adamant, he announced, changed his bowl.
I beg your pardon?
Demanded Ignatha Forel.
Yes, for 30 years it had a scratch on the bottom. This is attested by phototypes. Then, during the final year of his meditation, shortly before his death, he made the scratch disappear.
Everyone had become very quiet.
Translate that into polycosmic language, please, asked Sur Asquin.
He found his way to a cosmos the same as the one he'd been living in, except that in this cosmos, the bowl wasn't scratched.
But there were records, phototypes of its having been scratched.
Yes, said Javarn. So he had gone to a cosmos that included some inconsistent records. And that is the cosmos that we are in now.
And how did he achieve this feat?
Asked Moira, as if she already guessed the answer.
Either by changing the records, or else by shifting to a cosmos with a different future.
Either he was a redder or an incanter,
blurted a young voice. Barb, performing his role as sayer of things no one else would say.
Well, that's not what I meant, said Moira. How did he achieve it?
He declined to share his secret, said Javarn. I thought that some here might have something to say of it.
And he looked all around the table, but mostly at Jad and Lodegear.
If they do, they'll say it tomorrow, announced Ignatha Forel. Tonight's messel has ended.
And she pushed her chair back, casting a baleful glance at Javarn. Emin burst through the door and snatched up her rucksack. Madam Secretary adjusted the badge around her neck as if it were just another item of jewelry and stalked out, pursued by her servitor, who was grunting under the weight of two rucksacks. I had grand plans for how I would spend the free time I had won in my wager with Archibald. There were so many ways I wanted to use that gift that I could not decide where to start. I went back to my cell to fetch some notes and sat down on my pallet. Then I opened my eyes to find it was morning. The hours of night had not gone to waste, though, for I awoke with ideas and intentions that had not been in my head when I had closed my eyes. Given the sorts of things we have been talking about lately at Messel, it was hard not to think that, while I'd lain unconscious, my mind had been busy rambling all over the local parts of hemmed space, exploring alternate versions of the world. I went and found Archibald, who had slept less than I. He was inclined to surliness until I shared with him some of what I had been thinking about, if thinking was the right word for processes that had taken place without my volition while I had been unconscious. For breakfast, I had some dense, grainy buns and dried fruit. Afterwards, I went to a little stand of trees out behind the first Sconic chapter house. Archibald was waiting for me there, brandishing a shovel he had borrowed from a garden shack. He scooped out a shallow depression in the earth, no larger than a serving bowl. I lined it with a scrap of poly sheeting that I had scavenged from one of the middens that secular people left everywhere they went, and that had lately begun to pock the grounds of this consent. "Here goes nothing," I said, hitching up my bolt. "The best experiments," he said, "are the simplest." Analyzing the givens only took a few minutes. The rest of the day was spent making various preparations. How Archibald and I got others involved in that work and the minor adventures each of us had during the day would make for an amusing collection of anecdotes, but I have made the decision not to spell them out here because they are so trivial compared to what happened that evening. Before it was over, though, we had enlisted Emin, Triss, Barb, Carvel, Leo, and Simon, and had talked Sir Asquin into looking the other way while we made some temporary alterations to her endowment. The fourth plurality of worlds messel began normally. After a libation, soup was served. Barb and Emin went back to the kitchen. Not long after, Orhan was yanked. Triss followed him out. About a minute later, I felt a coded sequence of tugs on my rope, which informed me that things had gone according to plan in the kitchen. The stew that Orhan had been cooking had inadvertently been knocked over by clumsy Barb. Between that distraction and the racket that Triss and Emin had begun making with some pots and pans, Orhan would be unlikely to notice that sound was no longer coming out of the speaker. I nodded across the table to Archibald.
"Excuse me, Fra Javarn, but you forgot to bless your food," Archibald announced in a clear voice. Conversation stopped. The messel had been unusually subdued to this point, as though all the Doines were trying to devise some way of restarting the dialogue while avoiding the awkward territory that Javarn had attempted to drag us into last night. Even in the rowdiest messel, though, any unasked-for statement from a servitor would have been shocking. Archibald's was doubly so because of what he had said. As long as everyone was speechless, he went on.
"I have been studying the beliefs and practices of the Matarites. They never take food without saying a prayer, which ends with a gesture. You have neither spoken the prayer nor made the gesture."
"What of it? I forgot," Javarn said.
Ignatha Forrell was giving Paphlagon a look that meant, "When are you going to throw the book at your servitor?" And indeed, Paphlagon now threw down his napkin and made as if to push his chair back. But Fra Jad reached out and clamped a hand on Paphlagon's arm.
"You usually forget," Archibald pointed out. "And if you like, I can list any number of other ways in which you and Orhan have imperfectly simulated the behavior of Matarites. Is it because you're not actually Matarites?"
Beneath the hood, Javarn's head moved. He was casting a glance at the door, not the one through which he and the other Doines had entered, but the one through which Orhan had left. "Your minder can't hear us," I told him. "The microphone wire has been cut by an Eda friend of mine. The feed no longer goes out." Still, Javarn remained frozen and silent. I nodded at Sir Carvel, who pulled aside a tapestry to reveal a shiny mesh woven of metal wires with which we had covered the wall. I stepped around toward Javarn, stuck a toe under the edge of the carpet, and flipped it up to reveal more of the same on the floor. Javarn took it all in. It is a fencing material used in animal husbandry, I explained, obtainable in bulk extramuros. It is conductive, and it is connected to ground.
What is the meaning of all this? Demanded Ignatha Forel.
We're in a sandbucker's basket, exclaimed Moira.
Her life as an extremely senior, semi-retired lorite probably didn't include many unexpected events, and so even something as mundane as discovering that she was surrounded by chicken wire seemed like quite an adventure. More than that, though, I believe she was pleased that the servitors had taken her exhortations to heart and gone out and done something that the Doynes never would have dreamed of.
It's a grounded mesh that prevents wireless signals from passing into or out of the room. It means we're informationally shielded from the rest of Arbre.
In my world, said Javarn, we call it a Faraday cage.
He stood up and shrugged his bolt off over his head, then tossed it to the floor. I was behind him and so could not see his face, only the looks of awe and astonishment on the faces of the others. The first Arbrans, with the possible exception of the Warden of Heaven, to gaze upon the face of a living alien. Judging from the back of his head and torso, I guessed he was of the same race as the dead woman who had come down in the probe. Beneath a sort of undershirt, a small device was attached to his skin with polytape. He reached under the garment, peeled it off, and threw it on the table, along with a snarl of wires.
I am Jules Verne Durand of La Terre. The world you know as Antarct. Orhan is from the world of Ernud, which you have designated Panji. You had best get him inside the Faraday cage before...
Done,
said a voice from the door. Leo, who had just come in, cheerfully flushed.
We have him in a separate bucker's basket in the pantry. Saman found this on him.
And he held up another wireless body transmitter.
Well wrought, said Jules Verne Durand. But it has purchased you a few minutes only. Those who listen will grow suspicious at the loss of contact.
We have alerted Surela that it might become necessary to evacuate the consent,
Leo said.
Good, said Jules Verne Durand. For I am sorry to say that the ones of Ernud are a danger to you.
And to you of La Terre as well, it would seem,
said Arcibald. Since the Doynes were all too speechless to rejoin the conversation, Arcibald, who'd had time to prepare, was doing his bit to keep things going.
It is true, said the Lateran. I will tell you quickly that those of Ernud and of Tro, which you call Diasp, are of similar mind, and hostile to those of Thos, which you call...
Quator, by process of elimination,
said Lodegear. I'd worked my way round to a place where I could see Jules Verne Durand, and so was feeling some of the astonishment that the others had experienced a few moments earlier. First at the differences, then similarities, then differences again, between Lateran and Arbran faces. The closest comparison I can make is to how one reacts when conversing with one who has a birth defect that has subtly altered the geometry of the face, but without the deformity or loss of function that this would imply. And of course, no comparison can be drawn to the way we felt, knowing that we were looking on one who had traveled from another cosmos.
What of you and your fellow Laterans?
Lodegear asked.
Split between the Phthosians and the others.
You, I take it, are loyal to the Ernud-Tro axis?
Lodegear asked.
Otherwise you would not have been sent here.
I was sent here because I speak better Orth than anyone else. I am a linguist, a junior one, actually. And so they put me to work on Orth in the early days, when Orth was believed to be a minor language. They are suspicious of my loyalty, with good reason. Orhan, as you divined, is my watcher, my minder.
He looked at Arcibald.
You penetrated my disguise. Not surprising, really, but I should like to know how.
Arcibald looked to me. I said,
I ate some of your food yesterday. It passed through my digestive system unchanged. Of course, for your enzymes could not react with it, said Jules Verne Durand. I commend you.
Ignatha Forel had finally recovered enough to join the conversation.
On behalf of the Supreme Council, I welcome you and apologize for any mistreatment you have undergone at the hands of these young—
Stop. This is what you call bullshit. No time, said the Lateran. My mission, assigned to me by the Military Intelligence Command of the Ernud-Tro Axis, is to find out
whether the legends of the Encanters are grounded in fact. The Urnutro Axis, which they call in their languages the Pedestal, is extremely fearful of this prospect. They contemplate a preemptive strike. Hence my questions of previous evenings, which I am aware were quite rude.
How did you get here? Asked Paphlagon.
A commando raid on the consent of the Matterites. We have ways of dropping small capsules onto your planet that cannot be noticed by your sensors. A team of soldiers, as well as a few civilian experts, such as myself, were sent down and seized that consent. The true Matterites are held there unharmed, but incommunicado.
That is an extraordinarily aggressive measure, said Ignatha Forel.
So it rightly seems to you, who are not accustomed to encounters between different versions of the world in different cosmi. But the Pedestal have been doing it for hundreds of years and have become bold. When our scholars became aware of the Matterites, someone pointed out that their style of dress would make it easy for us to disguise ourselves and infiltrate the Convox. The order to proceed was given quickly.
How do you travel between cosmi? Paphlagon asked.
There is little time, said Jules Verne Durand, and I am no Theor.
He turned to Sura Moira.
You will know of a certain way of thinking about gravity, likely dating to the time of the Harbingers, called by us general relativity. Its premise is that mass energy bends space-time.
Geometrodynamics, said Sura Moira.
If the equations of geometrodynamics are solved in the special case of a universe that happens to be rotating, it can be shown that a spaceship, if it travels far and fast enough,
will travel backwards in time, said Paphlagon. Yes, the result is known to us. We always considered it little more than a curiosity, though.
On Laterre, the result was discovered by a kind of sant named Gödel, a friend of the sant who had earlier discovered geometrodynamics. The two of them were, you might say, fras in the same math. For us, too, it was little more than a curiosity. For one thing, it was not clear at first that our cosmos rotated.
And if it doesn't rotate, the result is useless, said Paphlagon.
Working in the same institute were others who invented a ship propelled by atomic bombs. Sufficiently energetic to put this theory to the test.
I see,
said Paphlagon.
So Laterre constructed such a ship and...
No, we never did.
Just as Arb never did, even though we had the same ideas,
Leo put in.
But on Urnud it was different, said Jules Verne Durand. They had geometrodynamics. They had the rotating universe solution. They had cosmographic evidence that their cosmos did in fact rotate. And they had the idea for the atomic ship. But they actually built several of them. They were driven to such measures because of a terrible war between two blocks of nations. The combat infected space. The whole solar system became a theater of war. The last and largest of these ships was called Dabin Urnud, which means Second Urnud. It was designed to send a colony to a neighboring star system, only a quarter of a light year away. But there was a mutiny and a change of command. It fell under the control of ones who understood the theorics that I spoke of. They chose to steer a different course, one that was intended to take them into the past of Urnud, where they hoped that they could undo the decisions that had led to the outbreak of the war. But when they reached the end of that journey, they found themselves not in the past of Urnud, but in an altogether different cosmos, orbiting an Urnud-like planet.
Tro, said Arcibald.
Yes. This is how the universe protects herself, prevents violations of causality. If you attempt to do anything that would give you the power of violating the laws of cause and effect, to go back in time and kill your grandfather.
You simply find yourself in a different and separate causal domain. How extraordinary, said Lodagir.
The Laterran nodded.
One is shunted into an altogether different narrative, he said,
with a glance at Fra Jad.
And thus causality is preserved in both the old and the new narratives.
And now it seems they've made a habit of it, said Lodagir.
Jules Verne Durand considered it.
You say now, as if it came about quickly and easily. But there is much history between the first advent, the Urnudan discovery of Tro, and the fourth, which is what we are all living through now. The first advent alone spanned a century and a half and left Tro in ruins.
Heavens, exclaimed Lodagir.
Are the Ernudans really that nasty?
Not quite, but it was the first time. Neither the Ernudans nor the Troans had the sophisticated understanding of the polycosm that you seem to have developed here on Arbre. Everything was surprising and therefore a source of terror. The Ernudans became involved in Troan politics too hastily. Disastrous events. Almost all of them the Troans' own fault, played out. They eventually rebuilt the Daban Ernud so that both races could live on it, and embarked on a second intercosmic voyage. They came to Laterre 50 years after the death of Girdel.
"Excuse me," said Ignatha Forel, "but why did this ship have to be changed so much?"
"Partly because it was worn out, used up," said Jules Verne Durand. "But it is mostly a question of food. Each race must maintain its own food supply, for reasons made obvious by Fra Erasmus's experiment."
He paused and looked around the messel.
"It is my destiny now to starve to death in the midst of plenty. Unless by diplomacy you can persuade those of the Daban Ernud to send down some food that I can digest."
Triss, who had returned to the messel early in the conversation, said, "We'll do all we can to preserve the Lateran victuals that are still in the kitchen," and hustled out of the room. Ignatha Forel added, "We shall make this a priority in any further communications with the pedestal."
"Thank you," said the Lateran. "For one of my ancestry, death by starvation would be the most ignominious possible fate."
"What happened in the second advent on Laterre?" asked Sur Moira.
"I will skip the details. It was not as bad as Tro. But in every cosmos they visit, there is upheaval. The advent lasts anywhere from 20 to a couple of 100 years. With or without your cooperation, the Daban Ernud will be rebuilt completely. None of your political institutions, none of your religions, will survive in their current form. Wars will be fought. Some of your people will be aboard the new version of the ship when it finally moves on to some other narrative."
"As you were, I take it, when it left Laterre?" asked Lodegear.
"Oh, no. That was my great-grandfather," said the visitor. "My ancestors lived through the voyage to Phathos and the Third Advent. I was born on Phathos. Similar things will probably happen here."
"Assuming," said Ignatha Forel, "that they don't use the world burner on us." I was just learning to read Lateran facial expressions, but I was certain that what I saw on Jules Verne Durand's face was horror at the very mention.
"This hideous thing was invented on Ernud in their great war. Though, I must confess, we had similar plans on Laterre."
"As did we," said Moira.
"There is a suspicion, you see, planted deep in the minds of the Ernudans, that with each advent they are finding themselves in a world that is more ideal, closer to what you would call the Hylian theoric world, than the last. I don't have time to recite all the particulars, but I myself have often thought that Ernud and Tro seemed like less perfect versions of Laterre, and that Phathos seemed to us what we were to Tro. Now we are come to yet a new world, and there is terrible apprehension among the pedestal that those of Arb will possess powers and qualities beyond their grasp, even their comprehension. They have exaggerated sensitivity to anything that has this seeming."
"Hence the elaborate commando raid, this ambitious ruse to learn about the encanters," said Lodegear.
"And Ratters,"
Paphlagon reminded him. Moira laughed. "It is third sack politics all over again, except infinitely more dangerous."
"And the problem we face is that there is nothing you can do to convince them that such things as retors and encanters don't exist," said Jules Verne Durand.
"Quickly, Adamant and the Copper Bowl?" asked Lodegear.
"Loosely based on a philosophy of Laterre named Edmund Husserl and the copper ashtray he kept on his desk," said the Lateran. If I was reading his face right, he was feeling a bit sheepish. "I fictionalized his story quite heavily. The part about making the scratch disappear was, of course, a ruse to draw you out, to get you to state plainly whether anyone on Arb possessed the power to do such things."
"Do you think that the ruse worked?" asked Ignatha Forel.
"The way you reacted made those who control me even more suspicious. I was directed to bear down harder on it this evening."
"So they are still undecided?"
"Oh, I am quite certain they are decided now."
The floor jumped under our feet, and the air was suddenly dusty. The silence that followed was ended by a succession of concussive thuds. These rolled in over a span of perhaps a quarter of a minute, 20 of them in all. Leo announced,
"No cause for alarm. This is according to plan. What you're hearing are controlled demolition charges, taking down sections of the outer wall, creating enough apertures for us to get out of the consent quickly so we don't bunch up at the day gate. The evacuation is underway. Look at your badges."
I pulled mine out from under a fold of my bolt. It had come alive with a color map of my vicinity, just like the nav screen on a cartabla. My evacuation route was highlighted in purple. Superimposed over that was a cartoon rendering of a rucksack with a red flashing question mark. The Doynes took the momentous step of pushing their chairs back. They were looking at their badges, making remarks. Leo vaulted up onto the table and stamped his foot, very loud. They all looked up at him.
"Stop talking," he said.
"But,"
said Lodegear.
"Not a word. Act."
And Leo gave that command in a voice I'd never heard from him before, though I heard something like it in the streets of Masht. He had been training his voice as well as his body, learning Vale lore tricks of how to use it as a weapon. I sidestepped past a stream of Doynes who were headed the other way, shouldering their rucksacks. I entered the corridor where mine was waiting. I hoisted it to one shoulder and looked at my badge again. The rucksack cartoon had disappeared. I strode out to the kitchen. Triss and Leo were helping Jules Verne Durand package what was left of his food into bags and baskets. I walked out the back of Avershawn's Dowment and into the midst of a total evacuation of the ancient consent of Tredegar. Thousands of feet above, aircraft were landing on the tops of the Thousander's Towers.
All of this business with the badges and the rucksacks had seemed insultingly simple-minded to me and many others I had talked to, as if the Convox were a summer camp for five-year-olds. In the course of a 15-minute jog across Tredegar, I came to appreciate it. There was no plan, no procedure so simple that it could not get massively screwed up when thousands of persons tried to carry it out at the same time. Doing it in the dark squared the amount of chaos. Doing it in a hurry cubed it. People who had mislaid their badges and their rucksacks were wandering around in more or less panic, but they gravitated to sound drummonds, announcing, "Come to me if you have lost your badge or your rucksack." Others twisted ankles, hyperventilated, even suffered from heart trouble. Military medics pounced on these. Grand Fras and Grand Sewers who failed to keep up found themselves being carried on Fid's backs. Running through the dark, mesmerized by their badges, people banged into one another in grand slapstick style, fell down, got bloody noses, argued as to whose fault it had been. I slowed to help a few victims, but the aid teams were astoundingly efficient, and quite rude about letting me know I should head for an exit rather than getting in their way. Ayla had really put her stamp on this thing. As I gained confidence that the evacuation was basically working, I moved faster and made a beeline through the giant page tree plantation, heavy with leaves that would never be harvested, to a rugged gap that had been blasted through the ancient wall. The opening was choked with rubble. Lights shone through from extramuros, making the dusty air above the aperture glow blue-white and casting long, flailing silhouettes behind the avowed who were streaming through it, clambering over the rubble pile, helped over tricky parts by soldiers who played flashlights over patches of rough footing and barked suggestions at any avowed who stumbled or looked tentative. My badge told me to go through it, so I did. Try not to think about how many centuries these stones I trod had stood until tonight. The avowed who had cut them to shape and laid them in place. Beyond the wall was a glacis, a belt of open territory that locals used as a park. This evening it had become a depot for military drummonds, simple flatbeds whose backs had been covered by canvas awnings. At first I saw only the few that stood closest to the base of the rubble pile, since these lay in the halo of light. But my badge was insisting that I penetrate the darkness beyond. When I did, I became aware that these drummonds were scattered across what seemed like square miles of darkness. I heard their engines idling all around, and I saw cold light thrown off by glow buds, by the spheres of wandering avowed, and by control panels reflecting in drivers' eyes. The vehicles themselves were running dark. Something overtook me, parted around me, and moved on. I felt rather than heard it. It was a squad of Veilers, swathed in black bolts, running silently through the night. I jogged on for some minutes, taking a winding route, since my badge kept trying to get me to walk through parked Drummonds. Another blown wall section, with its mountain of light, passed by on my right, and I saw yet another swinging into view around the curve of the wall. All of these gaps continued to spew about, so I didn't get the sense that I was late. Here and there I'd spy a lone Fra or Sewer, face illuminated by badge light, approaching the open back of a Drummond, eyes jumping between badge and vehicle, the face registering growing certainty. Yes, this is the one. Hands reaching out of the dark to help them aboard, voices calling out to them in greeting. Everyone was strangely cheerful, not knowing what I and a few others now knew about what we were getting into. Finally, the purple line took me out beyond the last of the parked Drummonds. Only one vehicle remained that was large enough to carry a cell of any appreciable size. A coach, gaudy with phototypes of ecstatic gamblers. It must have been commandeered from a casino. I could not believe that this was my destination, but every time I tried to dodge around it, the purple line irritably re-vectored itself and told me to turn back around. So I approached the side door and gazed up the entry stair.
A military driver was sitting there, lit by his jija.
"Erasmus of Edhar,"
he called out, apparently reading signals from my badge.
"Yes?"
"Welcome to cell 317,
he said, and with a jerk of the head, told me to come aboard.
"Six down, five to go,"
he muttered, as I lurched past him.
"Put your pack on the seat next to you. Quick on, quick off."
The aisle of the coach and the undersurfaces of the luggage shelves were lined with strips that cast dim illumination on the seats and the people in them. It was sparsely occupied. Soldiers, talking on or busy with jijas, had claimed the first couple of rows. Officers, I thought. Then, after a few empty rows, I saw a face I recognized. Saman, lit by his super jija as usual. He glanced up and recognized me, but I didn't see the old familiar grin on his face. Instead, his eyes darted back for a moment. Gazing into the gloom that stretched behind him, I saw several rows of seats occupied by rucksacks. Next to each was a shaven head, bowed in concentration. I stopped so hard that my pack's momentum nearly knocked me over. My mind said, "Boy, did you ever get on the wrong coach, idiot?" And my legs tried to get me out of there before the driver could close the door and pull out. Then I recalled that the driver had greeted me by name and told me to come aboard. I glanced at Saman, who adopted a sort of long-suffering expression that only an Ita could really pull off, and shrugged. So I swung my pack down into an empty row and took a seat. Just before I sat down, I scanned the faces of the Veilers. They were Fra Osa, the FAE, Sur Vey, the one who had sewn me back together with fishing line, Sur Esma, the one who had danced across the plaza and mashed, charging the sniper, and Fra Gratho, the one who had placed his body between me and the Geith leader's gun, and later disarmed him. I sat motionless for a while, wondering how to get ready for whatever was to come, wishing it would just start. Next on the coach was Jessery. He saw what I had seen. In his face, I thought I read some of the same emotions, but less so. He'd already been picked to go to space. He was probably expecting something like this. As he walked past me, he socked me on the shoulder.
"Good to be with you," he said. "There's no one I would rather be vaporized with, my Fra."
"You're getting your wish," I said, recalling the talk we'd had at Appert.
"More of it than I wished for,"
he returned, and banked down into the seat across the aisle from me. A few minutes later, we were joined by Fra Jad, who sat alone behind the officers. He nodded to me, and I nodded back. But once he had made himself comfortable, the Veilers came up the aisle one by one to introduce themselves to him and to pay their respects. A young female Ita came in, followed by a very old male one. They stood around Saman for a few minutes, reciting numbers to one another. I fancied that we were going to have three Ita in our cell, but then the two visitors walked off the coach and we did not see them again. When Fra Arcibald arrived, he stood at the head of the aisle next to the driver and considered fleeing for a good half minute. Finally, he drew an enormous breath, as if trying to suck every last bit of air out of the coach, and marched stolidly up the aisle, taking a seat behind Jesri.
I had damned well better get my own stained glass window for this.
Maybe you'll get an order, or a consent, I proposed.
Yes, maybe, if such things continue to exist by the time the Advent is finished.
Come off it. We are the Hylian theoric world of these people, I said. How can they possibly destroy us?
By getting us to destroy ourselves.
That's it, said Jesri.
You, Arcibald, just appointed yourself the morale officer for Cell 317.
Jesri didn't understand some of the remarks that Arcibald and I had exchanged, and so we set about explaining what had happened at Messel. In the middle of this, Jules Verne Durand came aboard, hung all about with a motley kit of bags, bottles, and baskets. His presence in the cell must have been a last-minute improvisation. Ayla couldn't have planned on him. He looked slightly aghast for a minute, then, if I read his face right, cheered up.
My namesake would be unspeakably proud, he announced,
and walked the full length of the aisle, introducing himself as Jules to each member of Cell 317 in turn.
I shall be pleased to starve to death in such company.
That alien must have some namesake, Jesri muttered, after Jules had passed us.
My friend, I'll tell you all about him during the adventures that are to come, said Jules, who had overheard.
Lateran ears were pretty sharp, apparently.
10 down, 1 to go,
called the driver to someone who was evidently standing at the base of the steps.
All right, said a familiar voice. Let's go.
Leo bounded up onto the coach. The door hissed shut behind him, and we began to move immediately. Leo, like Jules before him, worked his way down the aisle, somehow maintaining his balance even as the coach banked and jounced over rough ground. Those unknown to him got handshakes, and hurrying clockwinders got spine-cracking hugs. Veilers got bows, though I noticed that even Fra Osa bowed more formally, more deeply to Leo than Leo to him. This was my first clue that Leo was our cell leader. We were at the aerodrome in 20 minutes. The escort of military police vehicles really helped speed up the trip. No hassles about tickets or security. We drove through a guarded gate right onto the taxiway and pulled up next to a fixed-wing military aircraft, capable of carrying just about anything, but rigged for passengers tonight. The officers at the head of the coach were its flight crew. We filed out, crossed 10 paces of open pavement, and clambered up a rolling stair onto the craft. I wasn't happy. I wasn't sad. Most of all, I wasn't surprised. I saw Ayla's logic perfectly. Once she had accepted that she was making the terrible decision, the only way forward was really to make it, to take it all the way, to put all of her favorite people together. The risk was greater for her. The risk, that is, that we'd all be lost, and she'd spend the rest of her life knowing she'd been responsible for it. But the risk for each of us individually was less, because we could help one another through it. And if we died, we'd die in good company. Is there a way to send a message to Sura Ayla? I asked Saman, after we had all claimed seats and the engines had revved up enough to mask my voice. I want to tell her that she was right.
Consider it done, said Saman. Is there anything else, as long as I have a channel open?
I considered it. There was much I should have said. Is it a private channel? I asked.
Don't be ridiculous, he pointed out.
No, I said. Nothing further. Saman shrugged and turned to his Jija. The craft lunged forward. I fell into a seat, groped in the dark for the cold buckles, and strapped myself in. Part 11. Advent.
Teglon. An extremely challenging geometry problem worked on at Orathena and later all over Arb, by subsequent generations of Theors. The objective is to tile a regular decagon with a set of 7 different shapes of tiles while observing certain rules. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Red light woke me, or kept me from sleeping in the first place. It was not the clear, cold blood red of warnings and emergencies, but pink-orange, warm, diffuse. It was coming in through the windows of the aircraft, which were few and tiny. I unbuckled myself, staggered over to one, for I had slept wrong and my limbs were tingling and floppy, and squinted out at a spectacular dawn above the same icescape I had recently traversed on a sledge. For a confused minute, I fancied we might, for some reason, be headed back to Ekba, but I had no success matching the mountain ranges and glaciers below against those I recollected. Out of habit, I looked for Saman, hoping he could conjure up a map, but he was huddled with Jules Verne Durand. Both were wearing headsets. Saman just listened. Jules alternated between listening and speaking, but he did a lot more of the latter. Sometimes he'd sketch on Saman's Jija, and Saman would transmit the image. I found myself irked. The Lateran's presence in cell 317 had seemed like a medal pinned on our chests. Through him we would know things, be capable of deeds beyond all other cells. But I hadn't bargained on the wireless link to the reticulum that would make him fair game for any Panchandrum who was feeling curious about something. They were pumping him dry before he was rendered useless by inanition. I couldn't hear a word because of the noise of the plane, but I could tell he'd been at it for a while, and that he was tired, groping for words, doubling back mid-sentence to repair conjugations. Orth was a murderously difficult language, and I thought it a kind of miracle that Jules spoke it as well as he did with only a couple of years' practice. Either Lateran's were smarter than we, or he was prodigiously gifted. Archibald was up, pacing the aisles. He joined me at the window, and we began shouting at each other. From our recollected geography, we convinced ourselves that we were descending from the pole along a more easterly meridian than the one that passed through Ekba. This was confirmed as we left the ice and the tundra behind, and entered into more temperate places. There was a lot of forest down there, but few cities. No wonder people were slow to get up. We had jumped forward through more than half a dozen time zones. I had fooled myself into thinking I had had a full night's sleep. In fact, I might not have slept at all. Leo had been sitting alone in the front row, trying to make friends with a military-style Jija. I noticed he had set it aside, so I went up and sat next to him.
"Jammed,"
he announced. I turned and looked back at Saman and Jules. They were peeling the phones off their heads. Saman caught my eye and threw up his hands disgustedly. Jules, on the other hand, seemed relieved to have been cut free of the rut. He sank back heavily in his seat, closed his eyes, and began to rub his face, then to massage his scalp. I turned back to Leo. "Such a move must have been anticipated," I said. But he had got into one of those Leo trances where he did not respond to words. I grabbed the Jija, whacked him on the shoulder with it, threw up my hands, tossed it aside. He watched me curiously, then grinned.
"The Eda can still make the reticulum run on landlines and other things," he said. "When we stop moving, we can get patched in once more."
"What are your orders?" I asked.
"Go to ground, which we're doing now. All the other cells are doing it too."
"Well, then what?"
"At the place where we're going, there'll be equipment prepositioned. We're supposed to train on it."
"What kind of equipment?"
"Don't know. But here's a hint. Jessery is in charge of training."
I looked over at Jessery, who had commandeered a row of seats and constructed a sort of amphitheater of documents all around himself. He was scanning these with an intensity that I had learned long ago never to interrupt. "We're going into space," I concluded.
"Well," Leo said, "that is where the problem is."
I decided to take advantage of the noise and of the fact that our wireless link was down. "What news of the everything killers?" I asked. He looked as though in the earliest stages of air sickness.
"I think I can tell you how they worked."
"Okay." He pantomimed a punch to my face, pulled it so his knuckles met my cheek and nudged my head.
Violence is mostly about energy delivery. Fists, clubs, swords, bullets, death rays. Their purpose is to dump energy into a person's body.
What about poison?
I said mostly. Don't go Kephidocles. Anyway, what's the most concentrated source of energy they knew about around the time of the terrible events?
Nuclear fission. He nodded.
And the stupidest way of using it was to split a whole lot of nuclei in the air above a city. Just burn everything. It works, but it's dirty and it destroys a lot of stuff that doesn't need destroying. Better to nuke the people only.
How do you manage that?
The amount of fissile material you need to kill a person is microscopic. That's the easy part. The problem is delivering it to the right people.
So is this a dirty bomb type of scenario?
Much more elegant. They designed a reactor the size of a pinhead. It's a little mechanism with moving parts and a few different kinds of nuclear material in it. When it's turned off, it's almost totally inert. You could eat these reactors by the spoonful and it would be no worse than eating one of Sura Ephemela's bran muffins. When the reactor goes to the on configuration, it sprays neutrons in every direction and kills, well, everything that is alive within a radius of, well, depending on exposure time, up to half a mile.
Hence the name, I said. What's the delivery mechanism?
Whatever you can dream up, he said.
What causes them to turn on? He shrugged.
Body heat, respiration, the sound of human voices, a timer, certain genetic sequences, radio transmission, the absence of a radio transmission. Shall I go on?
No. But what kinds of delivery mechanisms and triggers is the secular power looking at now? He got a distant look.
Remember, launching mass into space is expensive. With the amount of energy it takes to launch a single human, you could get thousands of everything killers into orbit. They'd be too small to show up on most radar. If you could get even a few of them into the vicinity of the Dabin Ernud...
Yeah, I can see the strategy clearly. Which leads to the profoundly sickening thought,
are we going to be asked to deliver these things?
Leo said.
I think the answer is no. If anything, we are going to be a diversion.
We'll distract them, I translated, while some other technique is used to deliver the everything killers. Leo nodded.
Well, that's inspiring, I said.
He shrugged.
I could be wrong,
he pointed out. I felt like going outside and getting some fresh air, in lieu of which I walked up and down the aisles for a bit. Jules Verne Durand was asleep. Next to him, Saman was bent over his jee-jaw. But I thought it was jammed. Looking over his shoulder, I saw he was making some sort of calculation. Looking over Jesri's, I saw that he was, indeed, reading the manual for a spacesuit. This demanded a double take. But it was as simple as that. Surave was in an adjoining row, poring over many of the same documents, swapping them with Jesri from time to time. The other Veilers were asleep. Fra Jad was awake and chanting, though my ears were hard put to disentangle his drone from that of the engines. I went back to staring out the window. We angled across a range of old, worn-down mountains and struck out over an expanse of brown that ran to the eastern horizon, the grass of the steppe browned by the summer sun. The craft was descending. A river flashed beneath us. Then the industrial skirt of a modestly sized city. We landed at a military airbase that seemed to stretch on forever, since land here was as plentiful as it was flat, and there was no incentive to make things compact. A canvas-backed military drummond came out to collect us. We had no windows and could not see out the front, but through the aperture in the back, we watched the streets of an ancient, none-too-prosperous city ramifying in our dust. There were more animals on highways than we were used to, more people carrying things that in other places might have been entrusted to wheels. Of a sudden, things got dense and old, all yellow brick adorned with polychrome tiles. A heavy shadow passed over our heads, as if we were being strafed. But no, we had only passed through an arch in a thick wall. Three successive gates were closed and bolted behind us. The vehicle stopped on a tiled plaza. We clambered out to find ourselves in a courtyard, embraced by an ancient building 4 stories high, stone, brick, and wrought iron, softened by cascades of flowing vines on trunks as thick as my waist. A fountain in the center supplied water for these and for gnarled fruit trees growing in pots and casting pools of shade on what would otherwise have been an unpleasant place to stand.
"Welcome to the caravansary of Elkazg," said a voice in cultured Orth.
We turned to see an old man in the shade of a tree, a man who did not seem to belong here in the sense that he was of an ethnic group one would expect to find in another part of Arb.
"I am the Herator. My name is Magnath Forl, and I shall be pleased to serve as your host."
After introductions, Magnath Forl gave us a quick explanation of the history of Elkazg. I made no effort to follow most of this, since I only needed a few cues and hints to reconstruct what I had been taught of the place as a fid. It was one of the oldest Cartesian maths, founded circa negative 1500 by Fras and Surs, who had personally witnessed the fall of Baz, and known Ma Cartas. They had trekked across forests and mountains to build this thing more or less out in the middle of nowhere, on an oxbow lake a few miles from the main course of a river. A trade route from the east crossed the river not far away, close enough to give them access to commerce when they needed it, not so close as to be a distraction or a menace. Centuries later, a rough winter followed by a stormy spring caused some trouble involving ice dams that altered the course of the river and turned the Oxbow Lake back into an active channel. The trade route adapted, choosing Elkazg as the best place to make a crossing, since one of the side effects of the math had been the development of a relatively stable and prosperous secular community around its walls. A certain kind of mathic personality would then have abandoned the place for something more remote, perhaps up in the mountains. The wardens of Elkazg, though, weren't that way, and had come to notice that the goods being carried on the backs of the beasts passing over the river included not just fabrics, furs, and spices, but books and scrolls. In a compromise that would have made Ma Cartas kick her way out of her chalcedony sarcophagus and come after them with a broken bottle, they had spun off a thriving side business in the form of a caravansary adjacent to the math and a ferry across the river. The one tariff that they charged was that the Fras and Surs of Elkazg be allowed to make a copy of every book and scroll that passed through. Books were copied whose meanings they did not even know, but they interpreted their mandate somewhat broadly and began as well to make copies of the geometrical designs that they saw on fabrics, pottery, and other goods. For these Fras and Surs had a particular interest in plane geometry and in tiling problems. So, to make a long story somewhat shorter, Elkazg had become synonymous in the minds of Theors all over the world with tiling problems. Important tile shapes and theorems about their properties were named after Fras and Surs who had lived here, or specific walls and floors in this complex. It was no longer a math. At the time of the rebirth, its library had been dispersed and copied all over the world, and the building had fallen into private hands. It had not been made over into a new math at the time of the reconstitution. Instead, as Magnath Forl did not come out and say, but as was easy enough to figure out, it had been taken over by a long-lived complex of financial interests similar to, quite likely the same as, the one that ran Ekba. Fra Jad skipped the intro and wandered off into some other courtyard. Elkazg had been big and rich, and its courtyards went on and on. Now it must appear as a large, rambling black hole in the population density map of the city, since the only people who dwelled here were Magnath Forl and another man who was his liaison partner, some visiting about, though these had all been sent packing yesterday, and a staff of janitors cum curators who looked after the place. For one of the problems with this kind of art, i.e. tiles cemented to stone walls, was that you couldn't cart it off to a museum. My brain ought to have been shutting down, since I'd essentially no rest since the shovel experiment at Tredegar the day before, and the time since then had been freakishly eventful. But the visual environment of Elkazg was overwhelmingly rich. Would have been so even had I not known that every pattern of tiles was not merely a mesmerizing, intricate work of art, but a profound theoretical statement as well, shouting at me in a language I was too tired or stupid to understand. This acted like a shot of jumpweed extract or something that kept me awake for another hour at the cost of some sanity. When I closed my eyes to get some respite from the relentless grandeur, questions crept out of the darkness. That our host had the same family name as Madam Secretary was, of course, interesting. Was it a coincidence that cell 317 had ended up here? Of course not. What did it mean? Impossible to say. Should I even be trying to puzzle it out now? No. No more than I should be trying to grasp the significance of the tiling patterns that spread over every surface around me and seemed to be trying to crawl beneath my closed eyelids and invade my brain. One of the courtyards was a decagon, of course. Fra Jad found it. The taglon had already been solved on it, perhaps by some master geometer of yore, perhaps by a syndev. None of us had ever seen a full solution in person before, so we spent a while gawking. Stationed around the edges were baskets of extra taglon tiles in a different color, which Fra Jad was nudging around with his toe. It occurred to me I had never seen him sleep. Maybe Thousanders did something else. We left him to the taglon. Magnath Forrell took the rest of us to the old cloister, which had not been remodeled in 5,000 years. That is to say, it lacked electricity or even plumbing. Each of us got a cell. Mine had a bed and a lot of tiles. I closed some preposterously ancient and rickety shutters so that I'd not have to see, and consequently think about, the tiles, then sunk to my knees and located the bed by groping.